You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Hey there, my name is Joe Fish, and I'm a producer at The Big Story, and welcome to our second ever listener feedback episode, where we go through some of the emails and voicemails that we've gotten from listeners of the show. I'm sitting here with, of course, Jordan Heath Rawlings. Hello, Jordan.
Hello.
Okay, so where I think we should start is an episode we did recently with the legendary Canadian broadcaster, Peter Mansbridge. That was fun, having Peter in the studio. I was a little starstruck. Interesting note, actually, when I was a kid, I was able to take a tour of the CBC and sit in his chair when I was 8 years old.
You should have told them that.
I know I should have told them that. I got cold feet.
Also, Peter Mansbridge showed up, and God bless Peter, rocking the OVO hoodie, which at his age managed to be decisively cooler than me and Joe without much effort.
That's true. And he was wearing Air Force Ones. It was not the outfit I expected, but he looked really good.
If you spend your entire career in a suit and tie, once you finally walk off the set and start a podcast, you better believe you're going to wear kicks and a hoodie.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, so we got, the conversation was just generally about getting Peter's opinion on what's happened to trust in mainstream media in Canada over the last little while. And, you know, as someone who was kind of sort of like the voice of Canadian news, I think, for quite a long time, it was kind of interesting to get his take. We did get feedback, though. I will read one letter that I thought was good. So this piece of feedback came to us from Matt, and it's as follows. I was interested to hear the conversation, but from this journalist who joined this profession as a second one after the Navy in my late 30s, I think the analysis slightly missed the mark. Very short version, I think Mansbridge is right. It's about trust in individuals. But I think that trust was earned in the past because news organizations were the only place to find out what happened. Now we can find out what online. And my readers, especially younger ones, come to me to find out the why. In my opinion, it is extremely hard to cover the how in a way that is unbiasedly objective and also fulsomely explain the why. To me, that disconnect is at the root of the loss of trust. Take the financial stat Jordan threw out. Headlines say economy is great, but my life is shit. Why would I trust the paper that implies my life should be amazing because the economy is? It is also, in my opinion, why The Big Story is journalism. It's a show about the why. Cheers.
That's nice of him to say that we're journalism.
Yeah.
I made it a point to say to Peter that I don't think we're journalism, but a lot of these letters changed my mind.
I don't say I'm a journalist, for the record. I tell people I work in journalism. I see us as being a platform for journalism.
So you're trying to thread the needle.
Sort of, yeah.
Here's what I'll say about what Matt had to say, and I largely agree with it. I was talking to a young intern this past week about getting into journalism, which is always a depressing subject to chat with youngsters about these days. But we talked about the new generation of journalists and how they deal with bias. And I agree with her, and I think I've always tried to do this on the show, is that where today's journalists will fall flat is by pretending they don't have biases or trying to hide it. Because in Peter's day or in days before that, all people knew of you was what they heard from you on TV or heard from you on the radio or what you wrote in print. That's not true anymore, right? Anybody who likes The Big Story can go on Twitter and find my page and pull up a lot of opinions. So they'll know when I'm full of shit and I'm trying to pretend that I'm totally neutral in a space where I obviously have clear feelings. So my biggest takeaway from the interview with Peter is that being transparent and objective with your audience requires a different approach these days, because you have to let them know where you're coming from, because they're going to find out anyway. And if you try to hide it, they won't believe you. And Peter never had to do that. And I think that is the fundamental dichotomy between the two eras of journalism. That's my spiel on the topic.
Right. The point he made was that he thought that news organizations should tell their journalists to stay, not, I don't know if he said stay off Twitter, but to limit what they're allowed to express on Twitter, which is a contentious one, I think.
I don't think you can do that these days.
Yeah.
I just don't. Maybe you could do it in an industry that was healthier and paid a lot more, and yeah, it would be worth it for them to stay off Twitter. But like, half the fun of being a journalist these days is being able to be in the public eye and have opinions and have your voice heard. And it's frankly not worth it economically or stress-wise otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. Yeah, I mean, this is a debate that was playing out when I was in school. I think I see both sides of it. I think, like, the new school, I think, rightly concludes nobody is objective. So we need to be honest about our biases. And that honesty will kind of, like, counterbalance our objective. Like, it's what you said, transparency. I do think, though, that there is value in the pursuit. In other words, like, there's things in our world and society that we know are impossible, like, you know, achieving perfect justness in our justice system or perfect equity in our society, and yet we strive for them anyway. So I think there, you know, some people would be of the opinion, why not objectivity too? We know it's impossible, but why not strive for it anyhow? I see that. I see the validity in that argument too. I think it's like everything, where you land is somewhere on that spectrum. And I think if you can justify it to yourself and if you do your job with integrity, it doesn't really matter.
You just tried to both sides that issue, which is another sin in new school journalism.
Yes, I guess it is. But that's okay. I'll transgress. And if you really disagree with me, write in and tell us why. We'll read it on the next episode. All right, let's move away from this inside baseball discussion of objectivity and journalism.
Yeah, now we're doing a feedback episode about objectivity and journalism, which is about as, like, my nose is touching my navel.
Exactly. All right, so let's move on to a more high-minded topic. Pornography is what we're going to talk about. We did an episode about a new bill that aims to restrict access to pornography in Canada. It'll age restrict pornography so that people under the age of 18 theoretically would not be able to access porn on the internet.
Theoretically.
And it would be incumbent, I think, on big porn platforms, ergo Pornhub, to put in place checks and balances to make sure that they wouldn't be able to access their site. Children, that is.
A journalism update here. In the weeks since this episode ran, I don't know if you saw, Joe, but they tried to do this exact thing in Texas and Pornhub checked out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They jumped ship.
Pulled right out of Texas, yeah.
Okay, interesting. So maybe that's a harbinger of things to come in this country. We'll see. I just wanted to read a funny response that we got to this one.
Yeah, this is good. This is the only reason we're really talking about porn, because kids are always going to find porn no matter how you hide it. But
probably.
But my guy here is great.
Okay. Hello, The Big Story Podcast. Pierre Poilievre seems likely to be our next prime minister. By the time he's made more cuts to the CBC, the only programming our national broadcaster will be able to afford will be low-budget porno. So I propose the government of Canada black out all foreign-produced porno sites and give CBC the exclusive license to produce good, wholesome Canadian content porn. He then he gives some pretty clever examples of the names of some of this low-content porn, but it's too inappropriate to read on air. But kudos to who wrote in for this. That'd be Dan from Winnipeg, actually. And then he finishes his email with, viewers can access porn and verify their age by entering their social insurance number on the CBC Gem video streaming service. Cheers, Dan from Winnipeg. I think that's great.
It is great.
All right, let's move on to another. I wouldn't say this is a contentious topic, but it was one that spurred a lot of feedback, and that's bagged milk.
People love bagged milk or hate bagged milk. Like I said on the episode, if you've ever encountered it, you have thoughts and feelings about bagged milk. Speaking of neutrality in journalism, it's pretty hard to be neutral about bagged milk.
Right. It's as American as apple pie, and it's as Eastern Canadian as bagged milk. Fair to say?
Fair enough. Wait, speaking of Americans, can we start? Because when I did this interview, I asked our guest to describe it, basically meaning to Canadians from the West Coast who have never encountered it. And I also said in the odd American who may be listening. And we got an email from an odd American.
Yep, that's true. All right, so this comes to us from said odd American. This is Burton, who said, after a couple of years of listening, it was nice to get a shout-out at the start of the March 22nd episode when you welcomed the, quote, odd American who listens. And I am odd, or at least I thought I was, until I learned about bagged milk this morning. Considering I usually listen first thing in the morning, I had to double-check my calendar to ensure it wasn't already April 1st. It's not, and bagged milk really is a thing? Odd. It's always fascinating to learn the little eccentricities that separate the U.S. from her both smaller and larger northern brother. But it got me thinking, what would be a good example of the inverse? Some oddly American quirk that most Canadians aren't aware of.
Fascism.
Very good. Our first and last odd American listener.
Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Jordan, of this? What do you make of this outpouring of feedback we got to this bagged milk episode? Most of it positive, by the way.
Most of it pro-bagged milk.
Yeah. What do you think of bagged milk?
I'm very pro-bagged milk.
Yeah?
I grew up with bagged milk. I think I said this in the episode. I grew up in a house with two brothers, so we went through an awful lot of milk, and it's just cheaper. And I went away from it when I was a childless adult or when we were a childless couple because you just didn't drink enough milk. It was just for coffee. But now that I have a kid again who goes through cereal like crazy, bagged milk is so cheap compared to buying it by the carton, like ridiculously cheap compared to the other ways of delivering it. So it's like, we all know I host a finance podcast now. This is affordable milk
right.
in this economy?
Yeah. We actually weren't a big milk family, and I grew up in a kind of not strictly kosher house, but a house that wouldn't mix milk and meat. Mm-hmm. So when we ate meat, which was often, we wouldn't have milk, which I think kind of limited our intake.
Right.
Which is why I've got these brittle bones as a 30-year-old, I think.
You're going to have osteoporosis because not enough bagged milk in your life.
Yeah, it's possible. And I do want to shout out, I'm not going to play the voicemail, but there was a listener who left us a voicemail where she pointed out that bagged milk is it's useful because now that plastic bags are disappearing from grocery stores, she uses these bags to clean up cat litter.
It's fair enough. I mean, you can still purchase bags.
Yeah.
But this is economical. We're talking about economy. Look at that. It is even totally 100% usable. Even the bag helps your household out.
Right. There we go.
We talked to Cory Doctorow, who is an expert on basically everything tech-related and yet had still been successfully scammed. And the whole point of the episode was to explain how it happened and to drive home to anyone listening that doesn't really matter how much of a tech expert you think you are, anybody can get scammed. And so this is an email that we got following that episode from Donald. So today I got a text saying that my parcel, which I knew was out for delivery, could not be delivered because of wrong address. I corrected the address on a Canada Post seeming site and then got a page telling me I needed to pay $1.47 for the change. I input my credit card info. Right after that, I started to wonder if the delivery was Can Post. That's not what Home Depot typically uses. So I locked my card and called the delivery company. Yep, not Canada Post, and they told me the text request was a scam. The scammers managed to charge $2 to me, a prelude. Anyway, in the back of my mind was your great episode on how anyone can be scammed if the timing is right. That was exactly the case here. I needed the parcel to be delivered in the morning, and I knew it was out for delivery. I'm sure your episode made me more vigilant. But I wonder, did the scammers know the parcel was out? How? I love the podcast. Listen to almost every episode. Thanks.
And by the way, just off the bat, I think what happened to Donald is more, it's more likely it's what Corey was talking about, that this was just a mass scamming operation and they happened to get Donald as a parcel was out. And I mean, we all have parcels out all the time.
So, yeah.
I mean, the odds are good. I've received that text message a million times while I had parcels out.
So. Yeah, this is definitely a result of just scammers taking advantage of the circumstances we find ourselves in. But the reason I read this and not Joe is because not just Donald, but our lead producer almost fell for a scam. Or did you
That's
fall
true.
For
I
the
did.
Scam? You
I
did.
Fell for
Tell
a
the
scam.
Story. How did you fall for the scam?
It's extremely embarrassing. It was a Saturday morning. My girlfriend had to wake up early and go to work. And I woke up early and I was a little drowsy. And I was just kind of scrolling on Instagram on my phone, as I do when I wake up. And I got an ad, and it's like, in retrospect, the stupidest, most transparent scam. It was like a guy in a walking through a warehouse with all of these like fancy designer clothes, all brands that I love, going like, yo, I can't believe these deals. These deals are crazy. He said something like that. He's like,
in that kind of accent?
Yes. He's like, these deals are insane. I can't believe it. Like that kind of thing. And I was like, oh my God. So it was for a company that I've bought clothes from before.
Okay.
That's what was so insidious about it. It was for this company, Zumiez, which I think is a West Coast, maybe even it's American or
But it looked like it was a legit company.
It is a legit company. They were using the Zumiez branding, I clicked the thing. It brought me to a page that looked exactly like the Zoomies, like, regular shopping experience. It just had all of these clothes that, and it was like, you know, it would be like a pair of shoes for $40 that would normally be like $150.
Okay.
And like jeans that would normally be $80, $25. Stuff like that. So
right.
I actually agonized because there was so much. There was like 100 pages on this thing. I was like, oh my God, warehouse sale for Zoomies? Crazy. I agonized for probably an hour and a half putting together like my whole
sick
cart.
Wardrobe
exactly.
update.
I thought it was the best. I got these Nike high top dunks. I was like, this is the most major score ever.
Oh man.
I don't know. And then it came time to put in my credit card, and I did. I put in my credit card and I hit, and then the screen just kept loading and loading and loading.
Ooh.
And while it was loading, I had this moment of clarity where I was like, wait a minute, is any of this even possible?
Is any of this real?
I was like, these Nike dunks for $25 when they'd normally be like $250 or $300. And then I looked at the name of the URL for the place where I input my card, and it was like paymentsonline.com.
Oh,
and
boy.
I was like, oh no. And I realized I'd been scammed. And I closed the page immediately, and I called my bank immediately and canceled my credit card. And luckily, no charges had gone through. But it goes to show. Like, I mean, I'm not like the most tech savvy person, but I'm aware of scams. We've done all these episodes about scams. I'm primed to see them, and I got taken in.
It just has to catch you at the right time, like hungover in
bed on a Saturday
morning
before
looking
you've
for
had
cheap
coffee.
Clothes.
Exactly. And also, I'm a deal, like I would say, like a thrift addict. So when I see good deals on clothes, it's like my favorite thing. So they got me.
There you go, though. But the good lesson from that is, like, honestly, and it's a very practical lesson. Check the URL. Always check the URL when you're putting in anything. Because I've had the same scam that Donald got, which is like, your package you need to pay. Sometimes you need to pay duty fees if you're ordering something internationally, and they will text you. And like, just check the website it takes you to if you click those things in the first place.
Yeah. And I would say on Instagram, when you get, even if it's a recognizable brand, don't follow the link from Instagram.
Right.
Leave Instagram and then try and find it through your browser.
Yeah, go to zoomies.com or whatever.
That's how I figured it out, is I went to zoomies.com and there was no warehouse sale. I couldn't get there through Zoomies, and I was like, I've been had. They got me.
You got had.
What do you call it? I'm a mark? What
a mark.
Am I?
You're a mark. You're a sucker.
A sucker. A patsy.
A patsy is a good one.
Patsy. That's what I am. So, cautionary tale.
We have, I think, before we go, one voicemail to leave you with.
Yeah.
This is a listener who was responding to our episode about the perilous future of festivals in this country at the moment, and not just festivals, but the entire arts scene. And it's a really detailed response. We wanted to leave it to last because we wanted to play the voicemail because she's clearly thought about this a lot and works in the space. So we will just do that.
Hi, Jordan. Big fan, avid listener, calling from Montreal. Thanks for covering the news about Just for Laughs. I want to add a little nuance to what your guest said, as the difficulty that Just for Laughs and other festivals are facing is indicative of a much larger issue within the arts and culture sector of Canada. Calling in as a semi-expert in the field, not to toot my own horn, just stating my credentials, I have a Master's of International Arts Management, worked on both the production side and sponsorship side of many of Montreal's festivals, including Just for Laughs. I ran an art gallery in Ontario for 4 years and a theater in Montreal for a year and a half before leaving the arts altogether a few months ago. Your guest spoke about the COVID emergency funding from governments drying out, and he's totally right about that. And it did have a major impact as audiences haven't fully returned to pre-pandemic levels yet. So the earned revenue from ticket sales isn't what it used to be. However, it's a much more systemic and long-term issue than emergency pandemic funding. Many arts festivals, including Just for Laughs and the Toronto Fringe, are, like virtually all arts organizations in Canada, not-for-profits, and they rely heavily on operating grants from governments year-round, every year. Over the past several years, we've been seeing funding decreases or freezes at virtually all levels of funding. Meanwhile, operating and production costs have skyrocketed. To bring an artist either to a festival or a theater that operates year-round, or to install their work in an art gallery, you need to pay them, as well as cover their transportation, accommodation, meals, So it costs at least twice as much this year as it did in 2019 per artist. You multiply that by 100, coupled with year-over-year decreased funding from arts councils, and we are all in hot water. On the operational side, all of our bills, including rents for the spaces we operate, have gone up, and many arts organizations have been forced out of their spaces due to lack of funds. Outside of the top of execs of major institutions, cultural workers are amongst the least remunerated groups in the country. We do what we do because we love it and it's a vocation, but it's always been hard and it's only getting harder. With stagnant funding, it's difficult to offer even a cost of living raise, let alone competitive salaries. The festivals have more visibility, and rightfully so, given the importance in our collective psyche, larger magnitude, and tourism dollars. Your guest was right in saying that the festivals are a launching pad for artists. But before they even get there, before they even get to the fringe or the new faces at Just for Laughs, they cut their teeth in their local theaters, in playwriting labs, and in artist-run centers. Organizations across the country that are all in dire need of additional grants, sponsorships, donors, and audiences. We're not just at risk of losing our marquee festivals, but the very fabric of our collective self-expression through arts and culture in Canada. And that's a big price for all of us to pay. My name is Anne-Sophie Grenier. Thanks for your show. Listen every day. Bye-bye.
Thank you to all of you who have written in. Always thanks to any of you who listen to the show and tell your friends and leave reviews on Apple and all of that stuff. And especially thank you to those of you who know more than we do about a given subject that we cover and help us out by following up.
Yeah, thank you guys for listening and looking forward to reading future correspondence. That's all for us. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And if you didn't, let us know.